Hola, Sao. So during this afternoon session, the meditation session, we'll do exactly the opposite of what the materialists appear to be doing. When they say, people like John Searle, and a very intelligent man, I have debated with him, he's very smart, he certainly knows his own theory very well, that introspection is impossible, and there is no space, there's no internal space of mental events. There is no such thing, right? And I think he's giving you, pointing out instructions to his mind. I'm not being sarcastic, but I think he's giving you some intimation, what's it like to have his mind, you know, if you can imagine it, you know? And when Daniel Dennett says, we are mindless robots made up of mindless robots and appearances don't exist, I can't imagine his mind. It's inconceivable to me. I mean, literally inconceivable. It's inconceivable how a man who is clearly intelligent, knowledgeable, rational, can say something that seems to me so patently absurd. But that simply means that his view transcends the limits of my imagination. That's just true. It's not pejorative, just true. And when this fellow at Duke, head of a whole institute there, a center at Duke University, another fine university, says we have no more access to our own thoughts than anybody else's. He says. Yeah. And Michio Kaku says there's no mind-body problem because there's no mind. And Graziano says no consciousness. How would this come about? And I think I'm just going to repeat something I said before, because I'm tempted to say, oh, they're stupid. But they're not stupid. They're delusional. No, they're not delusional. They're heads of, you know, they're faculty members in major universities, outstanding universities. But what's happening there? They have trained themselves, and they're in an environment where this is absolutely acceptable to focus 100% on the outer world. And if you get any impressions, ignore them because they're misleading, because there is no internal. Is nothing going on inside. There's only outside. And so you recall that it came up in one of the texts, this where awareness merges with the object, not in some mystical unity, but you just lose your mind. You literally lose your mind because your awareness is totally fused with the objects that you're attending to, and for the moment what you attend to is reality. And the only thing, the things that are real to you are the objects of your awareness, because your awareness fuses with those objects and that's all that's real. This all makes very good sense if that's how you're viewing reality. I wouldn't view reality like that, except for maybe at a, like, you know, like a 5-minute dose for all the world, all the money in the world. But it is a commonplace now, otherwise it wouldn't be published in our major media outlets and being promoted by major media universities and not only the United States. So there's that, where there's such a fusion with the outer that only that is real. The internal is deemed non-existent or at best illusory. Don't even look, because it's completely misleading, right? And it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist, right? And now, there's a bit of repetition, but we can relate to the meditation we're about to do. And now, imagine doing just the opposite of that. Imagine you're a yogi living in India 1,200 years ago, and you head off to the Himalayas, you find a really cool cave, and you just sit and you practice. You're following this trajectory of Mahamudra, following in the footsteps of Saraha and others, and you just bring your awareness right in upon itself. And you're simply dwelling there, just withdrawn from all appearances, and simply dwelling in the awareness of awareness of awareness of awareness. And when you do take a little break and you attend to appearances, having so immersed yourself in awareness, you see, this is real. This is as real as anything ever gets. Awareness is real, because you see it, it's real. And then you turn your attention outwards to appearances and say, well, the appearances are real, but the appearances are completely misleading, because it would suggest there's actually a physical world out there, and that's complete. There is no physical world out there. I mean, at all. There's no physical world out there, independent of these appearances. It's just appearances is all you get. That's it. And if you imagine there's anything beyond that, you're simply delusional. And then you just go right back to home and you rest in awareness, awareness, awareness. So it's marvelous, the perfect symmetry here. that there's no physical world out there at all. But if you look, you'll just get misleading impressions. So why even bother to look? Why look at a liar? Why listen to somebody who just lies to you all day? And that's what Daniel Dennett would say if you try to introspect. And that's what the Chittamatrans would say if you try to extrospect. It's perfect symmetry. Perfect symmetry. But because whatever our personal beliefs are, all of us in this room have been drenched in the muddy waters of modernity. You know, we've gotten this. We can't be untouched by it. Even if we don't believe any of it, we can't be untouched by it. And so what I'd like to do in this next session is to do the opposite of this fusion with the outer, the obsession, the fixation, the myopic tunnel vision of focusing only on the objective and thinking the objective, which is physical, is the only thing that's real. Therefore, the only things that are real in the universe are physical, and anything that can't be physically perceived does not exist at all. And there are intelligent people who say exactly that. Let's turn that right around. It's kind of like an inoculation against modernity, you know, so that you don't get any of those symptoms, because they're real killers. It's not just that I disagree. But if that's your attitude, then when you pursue happiness, you're going to be looking in one direction only. Outer. Hedonism, consumerism. And of course, we all, as I said in the lecture a couple of days ago, we all human beings, we not only want to be happy, we want to be happier. And if the definition of happier is more of the same, then we got 7.3 billion people all wanting to consume more and more and more until the world is dead. And then we'll just keel over. With 8 people hiring Elon Musk to get him a super rocket ship to go to the nearest planet about 40 light years away, and they'll make it. They'll just go, you know, they'll just get frozen. And they say, hasta la vista, sucker. And they'll go off to another planet to devour. Earthlings, the planet devours. We don't even need a Death Star, we just need people. So we'll do just the opposite, but now where this is where it's getting interesting. My little diatribe's finished, in case you're wondering. I just finished. And now we have some fun. Now that we're, you know, slipping out of the, you know, that open sewer called, you know, modernity and materialism, and slip into the cool, refreshing waters with the 8 qualities of sublime water, the ambrosial waters of Dharma, then you'll recall as we did that kind of that regression yesterday, where we're coming through the thick coils of a conceptual mind and the world that we conceive, and withdrawing from that into coarse mentation, and withdrawing from that into subtle mentation, and see if we can see face to face that impulse of I am, right? That klishtamana. See if we can see that nakedly and see whether there's anybody there, right? We did that yesterday, right? So let's do something even more interesting today. And there's a symmetry. Once again, there's a symmetry here. And that is looking forward to the future when you will achieve shamatha. You'll know what's going to happen. If you're following the settling the mind in its natural state, you know exactly what's going to happen. You have a very clear idea. This is a trail that's been traveled by thousands and thousands of yogis. You know, they've given you the tour guide. And so, or the tour manual, you know, the guidebook, there you are. And so you know what's going to happen. You're going to be focusing single-pointedly on that space of the mind, the substrate. It's going to be empty. And then you're going to invert your awareness in upon itself, and you're going to be experiencing the substrate consciousness indivisible from the substrate. Because it's not the substrate consciousness over there and over you know, over here, and then over yonder is the substrate. That substrate consciousness, that substrate, that's beneath, that's prior to the activation of the klishtamanas, right? Substrate, subject consciousness, klishtamanas. You're going back prior to that. So you're not healed from any of the self-grasping. But it's gone dormant, largely dormant. No wonder it's blissful. Freedom of affliction is blissful. Freedom from the first two noble truths is blissful. You don't need to find bliss someplace else. It's just what's left when you're not beating yourself up with mental afflictions all the time. That's good news. And so, when you then achieve that, you can imagine this. It's not inconceivable. This coextensiveness of your experience of the substrate, and like sheet lightning that just completely saturates it, the substrate consciousness completely permeates that space, and that space is open, unimpeded, no center, no periphery. And so the whole space is indivisibly illuminated by the substrate consciousness, right? So no wonder people might get there. And if they haven't had good teachers and really some rigorous teaching, they could very easily think, hallelujah, I think I'm an Arya Bodhisattva. Because I'm realizing emptiness, and it's blissful, and it's luminous, and this, emptiness couldn't be better than this. This is fantastic. I love it. And you think you're an Arya Bodhisattva. Or if you've been trained in Mahamudra Dzogchen, of course you're going to think, boy, Rigpa is just as good as I thought it would be. This is Rigpa indivisible from Dharma Dhatu. I'm seeing the Dharma Dhatu. My awareness is Rigpa. It's indivisible from Dharma Dhatu. Yeehaw, Dzogchen's great. And you haven't even moved one hair's breadth along the path, right? This is why it's not a waste of time, even wherever we are in the practice right now. Know this well in advance, because if you don't really know it before you get there, when you get there, you're going to say, no, no, this is it. This is definitely it. You know, if Tibetans were doing this 150 years ago, and it was commonplace, as Panchen Lhotse Shukyi Gyantsen says, a commonplace to think this is something, you know, way, way up in the path. And that's from the 17th century. Right. And then Dujum Lingba says the same thing in the 19th century. This means this wasn't just a few weirdos here and there, you know, ignorant people who were just kind of stupid. It looked like it was quite common for people to get this and then say, oh, Rigpa, one taste, a non-meditation, Mahamudra, and so forth. They wouldn't, these great masters wouldn't keep on saying this if you're just kind of a weirdo here or there that was so stupid they fell into that, right? So that's looking ahead at this indivisibility, your experiential indivisibility of your experience of the substrate consciousness, which is the consciousness of the substrate, right? But now let's go back in terms of that emergence, that genesis from the substrate to the substrate consciousness to the Klishta Manas and so forth. Let's go back, and that's what we're going to do right now, to go back, see if we can get on the far side. Do our best. On the far side of the Klishta Manas, that congealing, that grasping. The Klishta Manas, of course, what it does right there, let alone all the mischief it leads to, it's bifurcating, it's breaking the symmetry of the substrate and the substrate consciousness. That's what it does. Because before that, the substrate consciousness was aware of the substrate, but there was a symmetry there. They were coextensive. But the Klishta Manas comes in, and it shatters it, and now there's a division. It's a very primal division, a division with not much content. Substrate over there, substrate consciousness over here, me over here, not me over there. It's really, really primitive, almost devoid of content, but the mischief has been done. The poison has been injected. And then just watch how that poison, when it gets into your whole bloodstream and into all your internal organs, watch what happens then, right? So what I'd like to do in this session is we're going to go to a practice that maybe I've touched on it fleetingly in this retreat. It's quite magnificent, and it's from Natural Liberation. It's Shamatha Without a Sign, Phase 1. Enjoy it. You're going to be a total anti-materialist by the time you finish. With the motivation of bodhicitta, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. In so doing, you are practicing engaged bodhicitta. You're setting out onto the path. Then let your eyes be gently open. Utterly relaxed, with no effort. Utterly normal, natural, blinking whenever you feel like it. You should feel nothing strange around or in the eyes. And evenly rest your awareness in the space in front of you, without it congealing, wrapping itself around any object within the visual domain. It can be helpful to do this practice later on outside where there's a great space in front of you. So when you release your awareness into space, it's not just the space of a room. It's space as limitless as the sky. Now, as a shamatha practice, which always implies that it's selective attention, deliberately withdraw your interest, and therefore your attention, from all appearances to awareness, the visual, the auditory, all sensory appearances, but also all mental appearances, discursive thoughts, images, and so on. Withdraw from them all. Do not exert yourself to extend, to direct your attention anywhere. So let your awareness simply rest right where it is, without exerting itself to look anywhere. Normally, throughout the course of the day, we are aware that we are aware. We're aware of awareness. Because we're aware of being aware of that, of this. But by a process of subtraction, you can still be aware of being aware. Without any outside referent. This is what is meant by shamatha, without a sign, without any referent, outside of awareness itself. So it's a very brief excursion into imagination. It's the type of awareness you would have if you were wide awake, very vivid and alert, and immersed in a perfect sensory deprivation tank, in which somehow even the mind had quieted down. So you're resting there with no appearances to any of the five physical senses or to the mind. You might be able to imagine that and to intuitively know that if you were wide awake, even in the absence of any appearances, sensory or mental, to your awareness, you would not become unconscious. You would remain as conscious as you were before you got into the sensory deprivation tank. But of what would you be conscious? Space? A vacuity devoid of appearances? And your own awareness? That's all that would be left. So rest in your closest approximation to that as you withdraw your awareness away from all appearances to awareness and sustain the flow of cognizance in what remains, having subtracted everything else. If it's true that for the moment what we attend to is reality, is our reality, then insofar as you're single-pointedly attending to and sustaining the flow of awareness of being aware, of being aware, like the sun rising over the horizon, your own awareness will become more and more evident to you, since you're not being distracted or drawn away or absorbed in any of the appearances to awareness or the objects of the mind. Rest there in the awareness of awareness, and let the light of awareness dawn upon you, like the sun rising from behind you. Do not search for awareness. Do not strive to identify awareness. It's already there and it already knows itself. Relax into, release into that flow of awareness knowing itself that's been there all along. Now, following the pith instructions of Padmasambhava, let's enhance the acuity, the sharpness, the clarity of this awareness of awareness itself. And it's Padmasambhava who introduced this method of release and arousal. So rest first of all in equilibrium, stillness. Awareness resting upon its own throne. And now, with absolutely no sense of contraction or withdrawal, which would probably entail some kind of imagination of converging inside your head, we should be entirely mistaken. But arouse, focus, concentrate the flow of your attention right in upon the unmediated experience of being conscious, to the exclusion of, withdrawing from, turning away from all appearances. Focus. Then release from your core. Release your awareness into space. Not focusing on space as an object, simply releasing into an open expanse, empty of any object, empty of any thought. Release your awareness into an objectless, open space. And having released, now again with no sense of withdrawal or contraction, simply enhance, intensify your awareness of one thing, awareness itself. Really focus, arouse, focus, intensify, enhance your awareness of awareness itself. Utterly release. Release your awareness into this objectless, concept-free, open expanse. Empty of any thoughts, any appearances, any objects. You may set your own rhythm, slow or fast, as you choose. But now add this element. As you arouse, focus, intensify your awareness of awareness. Sustain the sense of the open expanse of space. Don't withdraw from it. Sustain that awareness of space as you accentuate the awareness of awareness itself, the clarity, the cognizance of awareness itself. And as you utterly release your awareness into space, sustain without any diminishing the awareness of awareness itself, you may set your own rhythm, or in the early phase of this practice, if you find it helpful, or insofar as you find it helpful, you may conjoin the rhythm of this oscillation with the rhythm of the respiration. As you're breathing out, release your awareness into space. As the breath flows in, arouse your focus in upon itself, awareness itself. Throughout the entire cycle, to the best of your ability, maintain a non-conceptual flow of cognizance. not spacing out, not labeling or conceptualizing, a continuous flow of silent knowing of space and awareness. And let the oscillation come to an end. Come to an end in the center, right in the middle. Not releasing out into space, not inverting inwards to awareness. Simply resting right in between. And sustain your flow of knowing of space while simultaneously sustaining the knowing of awareness. This is shamatha. Now draw out the sharp sword of vipassana, of prajna, with a question. Can you identify the separation, the demarcation, the border between awareness and space? Between the awareness of space and the awareness of awareness. And if you recognize the emptiness, the absence of any such separation between the apprehender and the apprehended, rest in that knowing of the non-duality, the inseparability of space and awareness. So here's one more marvelous symmetry. Scientists love symmetry. I love it too. And that is, you may come to this conclusion quite rationally as a jitamatran. If this is where your attention is focused, and for the moment what you attend to is real, all that's real. When you really immerse yourself in that kind of samadhi, all that's real is awareness and appearances to awareness. All that's real is mind. Everything else is epiphenomena at best, but nothing whatsoever independent of mind. And that's exactly where Dujum Lingpa leads us, that the mind is the all-creating sovereign. That's a lot of ontological weight to say that. The mind is the creator of samsara and nirvana. I mean, that's God. It doesn't get any more ontologically heavier than that. So this great super agent, and it's your own mind, not Buddha's mind or Samantabhadra's mind, it's your mind that is a creator of your samsara and nirvana. He sets it up. He sets it up like a target. And then he gives you the shotgun of vipassana to examine, does this mind, is it really there? If so, where did it come from? Where is it? And where does it go? And you hit a bullseye and it just shatters. And the whole notion of reification now of anything is vanished, because you've already stopped reifying the external physical world to the point of oblivion that doesn't exist at all. That's pretty persuasive, or pretty conclusive. But then you come on the one thing that you said, okay, this is one thing that stands, and this is now, that reification is completely shattered, like you nuked it. But if this is shattered, then you either wind up a total nihilist, or you balance out. And you see, aha, there's that mid-range of appearances and awareness, obviously empty. But now, nominally speaking, we can speak of a physical world that's there when you're not looking at it. And we can speak of a mind that is an agent that thinks, that observes, nominally. And so then we, once again, accept an outer world and an inner world. But just as appearances do not exist independently of the awareness of them, and the awareness of appearances, you and hyphenate that, the awareness of appearances doesn't exist independently of appearances. Right? I mean, you can't have awareness of appearances with no appearances. I just got immersed in that, kind of lost my mind. Let's see if I can get my mind so I can talk again. Ah, yeah. So as that is the case, that the awareness of appearances rises relative to appearances, and appearances rise relative to awareness, but neither one exists independently. In a similar fashion, not identical though, the objects that we conceive in the outer world are there when we're not looking, but they're not there when we're not conceiving. That is, they do not exist independently of the mind that conceptually designates them. Having conceptually designated them, they may exist, and they do, like Higgs bosons. I don't know any physicist that thinks Higgs bosons came into existence several years ago when they were discovered with a Large Hadron Supercollider. Physicists believe all kinds of things, but I don't know one that thinks that. They actually invented Higgs bosons, and they didn't exist prior to that moment. Otherwise, it'd be just a joke. Why do you need $7 billion to just create a Higgs boson, a name? You know, really, what a joke. But it's not a joke. They discovered it, and from that cognitive frame of reference, now Higgs bosons have existed since the very, very early phase of the universe. And they will exist, continue for billions of years in the future, and they do exist for billions of light years in all directions. Relative to that cognitive frame of reference, whether or not you're looking, even if the Higgs boson shuts down, it will. But as long as that conceptual framework is in place, Higgs bosons do exist relative to that conceptual framework, relative to that cognitive frame of reference, in which the word Higgs boson means something, and it fits within this very, very sophisticated framework of the standard theory of elementary particles. And just as the world exists, as you conceive it, but of course you have many choices, there's not just one, right? So likewise with the physical world, the external physical world that exists when you're not looking at it, likewise with the mind when you're not looking at it. Because we're often not looking at the mind, like in deep sleep. You don't have no mind, you're just not experiencing any mind. But that doesn't mean you become absolutely mindless when you're in deep dreamless sleep. It exists relative to the cognitive framework in which you can designate, conceptually designate, the mind that is the agent, observer, and so forth. What's extraordinary about this is there is the Madhyamaka or the Dzogchen and the Dujum Lingpa approach to draw you into being a Chittamatran and then nuking it and then coming out with symmetry. Externally, yes. Internally, yes. In between, yes. But only relative to cognitive frames of reference. And therefore, all three empty. The internal is empty because the awareness and appearances are mutually interdependent and not identical. This is empty because it doesn't exist independently of the conceptual designation of mind, and that whole physical universe out there is empty, independent of any conceptual designation of a physical universe out there. What I find fascinating here is that then we have this whole other trajectory from the time of Galileo, primarily up until right now, where we have physicists, for example, intently looking outwards, never getting any professional encouragement whatsoever to look inwards. It's just not in the job description, either as a student, a researcher, a teacher, or anything. It's just not in the job description. Now, physics 303 is now look at your mind. It's not any chapter. So they're 100% looking outwards. But the amazing thing here is that when they do that with brilliance, and with backed up this wonderful dance between theoretical advances in theoretical physics and advances in experimental physics, the two like two pedals on a bicycle, each advancing the other, you get to the late 20th century, and lo and behold, we have these the early and late 20th century, these brilliant, brilliant physicists saying, you know that physical universe out there, independent of all measurements? It's meaningless even to talk about it, because you'll never be able to know it if it's there. And whatever you say about it is unverifiable and irrefutable. So why even talk? You're wasting your air. So they just release it. A physical universe, not the physical universe. None of them say the physical universe doesn't exist. They just say to talk about it as something that exists in and of itself out there prior to and independent of any system of measurement, independent of any cognitive framework, is completely meaningless, which is worse than wrong. If you say in Italy they drive on the left-hand side of the road, that's wrong. If you say in Italy, that's not even wrong. That was just noise. That's amazing. But of course they're left with one thing, the role of the observer, and they don't have a clue. They really need some help. And they're not going to get it from the neuroscientist. And then they're not going to get it from psychologists who tell them that all appearances are just hallucinations and you don't have introspection and you can't observe your mind and so forth and so on. That's not going to be helpful. Symmetry is beautiful. One might kind of think there's a master plan here of not letting them get any access to Madhyamaka or Dzogchen until they'd outgrown mechanistic materialism of the 19th century. It would have been completely wasted on them. I mean, completely wasted. Yeah. It'd be like feeding a frog cordon bleu. I think that is indeed the first time that analogy has been given, so you can note the date. Hola, so hey, let's get back to Lomachenpa. Let's quit messing around in the 20th century or 21st century. So here we are, towards the bottom of page 18. He'll continue. I think this is going to be pretty self-explanatory. Let's just read through and see if there's any bumps on the road. He's just emphasizing again, from his perspective, as one who is awake and seeing us dreaming from his perspective, and then we have our dreams within our dreams and thinking they're not real, but this dream is real. And he's saying they're equally unreal completely from his perspective, although they're not equally unreal from our perspective. Fair enough. But he's trying to bump Dutamalinga out of his perspective as a sentient being. That's the whole point. That's the ontological shock therapy. Not to take you step by step by step to be a better sentient being, better sentient being, better sentient being, but just to say, basta. You know, like that's Italian for pet. You know. Just stop being a sentient being, for crying out loud. Did you not know there was a choice? You can stop right now. Stop. And then see what remains when your mind stops. Because that's the point of pet. Pet is like slamming a door on your sentient being's mind. And then seeing what's left. So from that perspective, until now, he's speaking to a person who still takes himself seriously as a sentient being, or at least is putting on a good show of it. Until now, you have eaten enough food to fill Mount Meru and drunk an ocean of liquid, but you still you are not full. You've worn a galaxy of clothing, but still you're not warm. Know that this indicates that these are mere appearances and are not established as real. Okay, that's self-explanatory from the perspective of Lomachenpa. Maybe not so clear, but he's drawing us as well. This isn't just for Dujumlingba. It is a great mistake not to recognize that what appears as your body is empty. It's a matrix of appearances. It appears, but it's not there. That's it. He's not even going to say, oh, it's not inherently real, but it's conventionally real, and then lead you on a merry chase of conceptual elaborations. He's just going to cut right through it. From my perspective, your body is not even really there. It's not there. It's an empty matrix of appearances. That's not a body. It's an empty matrix of appearances. But it's a mistake to take that body that is utterly empty of any kind of identity of its own and cling to it as real, to reify it. This attitude of reifying one's own body and, of course, then identifying with one's body. He's going to really hammer this one home. It's reifying and then identifying. Reifying and then identifying as mine or even as me. And the materialists are encouraging you to embrace the dumbest of the dumb. Really, in this regard, the dumbest of the dumb. Not only that this body is real and that it's yours, but it in fact is equivalent to you. It doesn't get dumber than that. and also destructive. It's terribly destructive, dehumanizing. This clinging, this reification, this identification with the body, this is a consuming demon. Since the efforts you make for the sake of your body eat away at the fruit of omniscience. In other words, like it's a parasite eating your lunch. It is a murderous executioner. He's not going to hold back here. It's a murderous executioner since it links one cycle of existence to another. That it's exactly that. That just keeps you going from lifetime to lifetime. Even in the bardo, it doesn't give you a break. Even in the bardo, you have this thirst, this craving, this clinging, got to get another body, got to get another body, oh. And then you get one, oh, happy days. And then you're just stuck in another rebirth, and it never ends. It links one cycle of existence to another, displaying the appearances of birth and death. But it's just appearances. You're not even born, you're not even dead. You're just delusional. It cuts your life force, since for the sake of your body, you seek happiness from clothing and so on. I mean, that's just flat out delusional. And you are imprisoned by clinging to attachments and aversions that perpetuate hopes and fears. Thus, your lifeline to liberation is cut. If we just slip back briefly to the non-lucid dream, where again, that continuity of mental consciousness is there. Your dream is illuminated by your mental consciousness. You're knowing things within the dreamscape. And of course, there is that current, that relentless, eternal current of caring. And within the context of what we regard as your non-lucid dream, and from your perspective, just what's happening, insofar as you're focusing on taking care of your body and clinging to attachments and hopes and fears, all within the context of that reality, what you call reality, then your lifeline to liberation is cut. As long as you're fixated on that, you'll literally never be free. Your attention will always be diverted elsewhere. Oh, he makes me so unhappy. She makes me happy. Oh, I hope I don't put on weight. Oh, I hope I don't get sick. Oh, you'll be totally absorbed. Really as if you've taken datura for eternity. And it asphyxiates you. If it wasn't enough, it murderously executes you and so forth. It asphyxiates you, for it robs you of the breath of eternal bliss. That is, you're strangling. You'll never find eternal bliss. You'll never find the unborn bliss of nirvana, of your own pristine awareness. You won't even find shamatha. So it's robbing you. It's taking all the breath out. Therefore, all those who cling to the objective appearances of the six kinds of consciousness, whereas materialists focus on the objective appearances of only five, really mentally impaired. But for those who at least have the sense that, yes, there are six domains of consciousness and six domains that we are aware of, well, then we cling to those. And those who cling to the objective appearances of the six kinds of consciousness are like deer that mistake a mirage for water and run to it. If you saw that happening, it's good to use our imagination. But imagine there's been a drought, drought that goes on for years and years, and the wildlife are just perishing, and these poor, emaciated, parched deer see a mirage on the horizon. And with their last bit of strength, they're running towards that mirage. What would you feel? You wouldn't feel contempt or disdain. You wouldn't feel how stupid. Sad. It's just sad, compassion. Yeah. And if you had any water, you'd want to come back. I got some real water. There's not even an iota of essence that is established as real. Even though you know appearances to be empty in this way, they might remain as before, as if they were truly existent, without turning into nothing. That's true. You realize you can be a great yogi and realize the emptiness of all phenomena. You come out of meditation. The appearances are still there. They still appear to be inherently existent. You know they're not. But the mere fact that if you realize that they're empty, they're all empty of inherent nature, you, your mind, and everything else, the appearances are still there, and they are still there. They don't turn into nothing. So if you wonder why it is necessary to know this, if nothing really changes, now I simply know the nature of phenomena, but they're still there. There's still butchers, and there's still misery, and there's still the world just going on. And I've made this incredible discovery, and the world is going on as if nothing happened. So what was the point? Why is it necessary to know this? He says, then consider, if you do not know that the essential nature of the object of meditation is emptiness, all your meditations will certainly turn out to be ethically neutral. This needs a little bit of commentary. I checked Sutta Kondo's commentary. I'll add a little bit of my own. He's referring here specifically, I think I found this in Sutta Kondo's commentary, to resting in awareness of awareness. So again, that's right next door. Methodologically, it's virtually identical to simply non-meditation. In terms of method, it's almost the same. One is imbued with a view, the other one's not. That's pretty much it. One still has some vestige of grasping, the other one doesn't. That's about it. But if that's what you're doing, if you're resting there in your best facsimile, this is really, really important. If you're resting there in your best facsimile, your best shot of non-meditation, and you've not realized emptiness, then all that's happened for that little while you're in meditation is you simply turned off, you put it to neutral, the engine of reification. Because when you're not doing anything, you're not reifying, not actively. So the engine's on, but it's not in gear. So it's just humming, 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 and you're just humming, 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 doing nothing, doing nothing, doing nothing. And oh, it's quite nice, it's very peaceful, maybe it's even blissful. And then you come out of meditation, and as soon as you come out of meditation, you get into first gear. And you start reifying everything again. Yourself, and everybody else, everything else. So in which case, that wasn't even virtuous. It wasn't even the virtue of giving somebody else a loaf of bread. At least that's virtue. It's not even virtue. It's just sitting there with the engine and idle, the engine of reification. And all the other mental fixings will come out of that. They're all just saying, oh, we can relax until he comes out of meditation. Then we'll beat the crap out of him again. So you're not making any progress. Now, the one thing that will make it something better than ethically neutral is if you're doing it, although without realization of emptiness, at least if you're doing it with good motivation, like bodhicitta, well, that would be good for something. But it's not going, it's not liberating at all. I mean, you can have the most sublime motivation, but if you don't have realization of emptiness, it is not liberating. It's not taking you one micron outside of samsara. Furthermore, you may wonder why the mere realization of emptiness should reveal the nature of non-existence, given that mere understanding and mere realization resulting from other visualizations and meditations are not liberating. So he stated before, you can be immersed, you're getting empowerment and have memorized the sadhana and studied all the commentaries of the sadhana and develop your shamatha and do fantastic visualizations and giving really, really good recitations. And if you are doing all those sadhanas without realization of emptiness, well, apart from your motivation, besides that, it's ethically neutral. It's not taking you anywhere. It's just kind of like a really nice play, you know. And so if those don't liberate, then what's liberating about realization of emptiness? Even if stage regeneration, with all of its elegance, its sophistication, its fantastic, all that, you know, the light show and so forth, if that doesn't liberate, then why does the mere realization of emptiness, why does that liberate? What's the big deal? And moreover, if everything is primordially empty, you may think that it makes no difference whether or not you know everything to be empty. If they're all if they're already empty, then that should be enough. They're empty. So you know it, you don't know it. What's the big deal? And he says, if so, consider this. Know that samsara and nirvana and liberation and delusion come about due to the differences between awareness and unawareness and between knowing and not knowing. Realize that awareness is essential. So if you don't care about whether you simply continue in samsara endlessly, or you actually achieve nirvana, whether you're liberated from delusion, or you simply wallow in delusion endlessly, if you don't care, then you don't need to care about realization of emptiness. But the distinction is the awareness or unawareness, the knowing or not knowing of emptiness. That's the crucial demarcation, not anything else, not samadhi, not bodhicitta, not the four immeasurables. It's knowing or not knowing the actual nature of existence, the nature of existence of all phenomena are empty of inherent nature. Realize that awareness, knowing, is essential if you have any interest in nirvana or liberation, let alone Buddhahood. So it's interesting the qualms he's raising here. They're very real qualms, and if they were real 150 years ago, I think they're, if anything, more pertinent now. And that's the impression I've had of Dujon Lingwa's writings for 20 years now, is that he seems so oriented to where we are living now, to my mind, more so than the cultural milieu in which he was first revealing these teachings. It's just my impression. But he continues with another qualm. Some people may think that if you can't understand this on your own, if you can't figure it out on your own, just go off and meditate, and if you can't realize emptiness on your own, then hearing teachings and contemplating them will be of no use. But since beginningless time, you've failed to realize this on your own and have wandered in samsara. For countless lifetimes in the past, we've been so macho, so self-reliant. What do I need religion for? What do I need a lama for? A priest? What do I need dharma for? What do I need? I can figure this out. I'm smart. And of course, we've gotten exactly here after countless eons of trying to guide ourselves. So, good luck. I don't think Einstein actually ever said it, but it sounds like he would have. Doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result. Definition of insanity. I don't think he said it, but he might have if he knew about it. In any case, that's what he's talking about here. Since the beginning of this time, you failed to realize this on your own and have wandered in samsara. You're still wandering in samsara. Know that through studying and training, you will realize emptiness. First studying, training, that is studying, hearing, reflection, and then meditation, you will realize emptiness, thereby gaining the view that accords with all the tantras, oral transmissions, and pith instructions. So what leapt out at me when I was reading and reflecting upon this, or just letting thoughts come up, is the statement by His Holiness. When asked, is it necessary to have a guru to achieve enlightenment? He said, no, but it can save you a lot of time. I mean, there are people like Mingyur Dorje, who is the young protege of Kamachame Rinpoche, who just came in, like, awake. And as a child, he was already, became the guru for his master, who was a tremendous scholar. But the child has such incredible natural intuition, insight, realization, that the guru is probably 30, 40, 50 years older than him, recognize, here's my guru. And so they have this reciprocal relationship. The child needing to be drawn in, wanting to be drawn into the lineage, the richness of the empowerments, the transmissions, and all of that, looked upon Karmachame, the great scholar and contemplative, as his guru. And Karmachame Rinpoche, looking upon this child, which is just this self-emergent yogin, recognizing this person already knows, and so what can I get from his own intuitive wisdom? If you're looking for something that's somewhat comparable to that, just listen to Kandola speak. Kandola speak. You know. By now, she's had a fair number of teachings, probably a lot of teachings. But when I first met her in 2008, I don't think she'd received many teachings at that time. She was still fairly recently arrived in India, and in Tibet, I think she had virtually no teachings. But it was like that. I mean, just the spontaneous wisdom that flooded. You just took your breath away. It was just amazing. So there are still people like that. So furthermore, whether you realize emptiness, this is interesting. It's kind of reassuring too. Furthermore, whether you realize emptiness after undergoing great hardships in studying, training, and so on, or you realize emptiness without experiencing the slightest difficulty, there's no difference. There's no difference in the quality of your realization. For example, whether you discover gold after undergoing great hardships, or you find it under your bed without the slightest difficulty, there's no difference in the quality of the gold. That's encouraging. That it's not necessarily, you have to go through so many hardships first. Well, some people yes, some people no. The consciousness that, so we're kind of wrapping up here, the consciousness that analytically ascertains all appearances as emptiness is called discerning wisdom. Wisdom also means intelligence. The continuum, so that's when you first get it. You got it. You've ascertained all appearances empty of anything behind them or any substance within them. Appearances are not appearances of something else behind them that's really there. That's the standard view in modern science. All these appearances, yeah, they're illusory, but there's something behind them that's absolutely real and objective and out there. Well, when you see that's not true, it's just empty all the way through. It's called discerning wisdom. But that means you have to see through appearances. You can't simply attend to them closely. And that's what we find in quantum cosmology. John Wheeler, Anton Seining, and so forth, they're not just looking at appearances. They're probing into, investigating, shattering the appearances and seeing that although it seems as if there are real elementary particles and so forth out there, it does not withstand analysis. It does not bear analysis. And you see they're empty. Quite amazing they did that. But of course, as far as I can tell, there's no benefit for the mind because it has no relationship to ethics, There's no cultivation of ethics to come to that conclusion. There's no cultivation of samadhi. There's no purification. There's no merit. There's no... It's just the insight. And so it's very hard for that trickle down. I was just reading a part of the dialogue between Arthur Zients, who's my mentor in physics, and Anton Seilinger. And he did research in Anton Seilinger's laboratory in Innsbruck. And where the two of them are talking, this was the meeting back in 1997, these two physicists. And Arthur Zients is who's an anthroposophist, and is a very serious meditator, written at least one, if not more, books on meditation. He's saying, you know, our experience, Arthur Zients was saying, our experience of the world is classical. Like the real chunky stuff out there, and they bump into each other, and there's absolute space, I can see it, and absolute time, and so forth. That's just how we see things in an everyday experience. But our quantum mechanics tells us that's not true. And Arthur Zients was raising the question, and he and I have known each other now for more than 30 years. We've had many, many discussions. And he's had long sessions with His Holiness Dalai Lama and with Thupten Jinpa. So he's not a Buddhist, but he's heard a lot of Buddhist talk about this. And he's saying, might it be possible through the cultivation of the mind to actually see reality as it is, rather than being stuck in this old, outdated, and completely false paradigm of an absolute objective world out there? He's raising the question, kind of optimistically. And Anton Seilinger, he said, I doubt it. I doubt it. Because he's just had no contact with anything that would give him the notion that it would be possible. It's just not part of Western education. Nowhere. Not even in religious studies. Nowhere. So, the continuum of subsequent consciousness after you've ascertained this emptiness that definitely ascertains samsara and nirvana as great emptiness, this is called the wisdom that realizes identitylessness or anatman of both kinds, personal and phenomenal. Once these two types of wisdom have been generated in your mind stream, there is first realization. In this context, realization means you know it, and then experience, you taste it. You really get it. You experience it. So we're not talking about something lighter, something actually deeper. Realization is knowing it, and then the experience in this context is actually just that. What can we say? It's experiencing it, right? And then finally acquiring indwelling confidence. And that's where you know it irreversibly. That is, you do not part. It's so penetrated your mind stream that it will never be pulled out. This is a crucial point. Moreover, we come to the conclusion here. Moreover, if you say that it is incorrect to assert that the body and so forth are not established except as mere appearances, if you say that's not true, all this stuff about the body and so forth being mere appearances, empty appearances, not really there, if you say that's false. And why? Because if the body of someone who has realized them as empty, all these appearances, all these phenomena, so you have somebody who's gained that realization, right? The body of someone who has realized them as empty, if that body is touched by fire or water or struck by an arrow, a spear or a club, then pain arises. So since pain arises, then the body must be really there. Otherwise, why would it feel pain? I mean, somebody hits you over the head with a club. Doesn't that disprove the emptiness of a club? And disprove the emptiness of your head. Hard versus hard. Spear, club, pain, arrow, fire, water. Isn't that about as real as it gets? Isn't the fire inherently real? Isn't that why it burns your body? Isn't the water inherently real? That's why you can drown in it, and so forth. So it's kind of like a Neanderthal approach or response to the sophistication of Madhyamaka. Inherently existent. You agree? Tell me when you agree. You can beat the crap out of it until they say, okay, I agree. It's kind of like, that's one way to do philosophy. You just beat people up until they agree with you. You don't think this is real? Try my knuckle sandwich. If that's what you think, until you reach absolute space, until you realize Dhamma Dhatu. This is definitely Dhamma Dhatu. Until you reach absolute space in which phenomena are extinguished. All phenomena means all appearances from your perspective in the center of your mandala. All appearances, all impure appearances generated by your karma and klesha from the past. Until you reach absolute space in which phenomena are extinguished in ultimate reality. This is the fourth realization, the culminating realization on the path of Dzogchen, deep into the domain of the direct crossing over. Until you are there, this means you've already realized Rigpa a long time ago, and you become a matured Vijayadatta, you become a Vijayadatta with mastery over life, you become a Mahamudra Vijayadatta, you become a spontaneously actualized Vijayadatta, your mind is, you know, inconceivable, and that, and then finally all appearances, all impure appearances dissolve irrevocably, irreversibly, until that happens, until they vanish. Appearances of benefit and harm will uninterruptedly arise. The appearance is still there. Do you have to experience them in the same way? No, not even remotely. Your way of experiencing those appearances can and does transform profoundly, but the appearances still arise. I mean, when Devadatta tried to kill Buddha with a group of thugs, and then a raging elephant, and then an avalanche, the appearances were there. Thugs came, the thumbs came to kill him, but then they were so moved by his sheer presence, they just prostrated instead. He sent a raging elephant after him, and the elephant just calmed down. The avalanche came down, it would definitely look like a big avalanche coming up. One little chip actually, you know, drew a little bit of blood from him. But the Buddha chastised Devadatta, I think at that point, and saying, Devadatta, I'm paraphrasing, give it a rest. I'm a Buddha, and I'll die when I say I die. I determine when I die. Nobody else determines. I live as long as I want, and I die when I want. And there's nothing you can do about it. So why don't you give it a rest? It's colloquialism, that's what he said. And the Devadatta, the poor guy, he never gave up. I'm serious. I was just reading up on this. The poor guy. He never learned. And even when he's just approaching death, he's crawling up to the Buddha as if in remorse, and he dipped his fingernail in poison, crawling up to the Buddha to try to scratch him as his last gasp. And the Buddha just pushed him away with his toe. And then he died. So that's hardcore. He didn't learn to his dying gasp. We're reading this account, it was from Mayana Sutra, but I think it's probably true of the Pali. I don't know, I'm not a scholar. But Ajatasatru, in Sanskrit, Ajatasatru, the prince who teamed up with Devadatta planning to kill the Buddha, his uncle, Ajatasatru, planning to kill his father so he can take over the kingdom. He succeeded. He tortured his father to death. But unlike Devadatta, Ajatasatru then saw the error of his ways. He saw the error of Devadatta's ways. He saw, and he felt tremendous remorse. And he came to the Buddha, just like, you know, ashes, just tremendous remorse for what he'd done. And the Buddha was so gentle with him. He killed his father. That's one of the five deeds of immediate retribution. It doesn't get heavier than that. But he came with this intense remorse for what he'd done. He tortured his father to death. And the Buddha said, your father forgives you. He's born in some deva realm. He forgives you. And he set his mind at peace. It's amazing. But Devadatta never felt remorse. Not in that lifetime. So until you reach absolute space in which phenomena are extinguished in ultimate reality, dualistic appearances do not subside, and until they vanish, appearances of benefit and harm will uninterruptedly arise. But in reality, even the fires of hell do not burn. As if he's awake and looking at somebody who's dreaming he's in hell and screaming in pain, and the person who's awake looking in upon the dream and saying, you're experiencing the appearances of fire and heat, but they don't burn. But I'm awake and you're not, so you suffer. With these words, he disappeared. So this is a marvelous segue to the next, the teachings of Sadaha. Because he just said, until you come to just the culmination of the path, you're almost finished. Appearances of benefit and harm will uninterruptedly arise. In other words, those of you who've, you know, when you meet with me, you say, oh, I had some good days and bad days. You're going to have good days and bad days until, you know, like the day before you become a Buddha. So get really used to it. Don't think that they'll be easier, necessarily. What can be easier is how you experience them. And that segues immediately into these teachings of Sadaha. And we move to the next category, the next outline heading. The last one was demolishing, or destroying the craving, the clinging to, grasping to appear, grasping to permanence, right? We had a couple of chapters on that. And now we go to the next heading, and that's counteracting the flaws of benefit and harm. So he just said, appearances, benefit, and harm, I'm going to be with you for the whole path, basically. But then how, in the midst of those appearances, how can you counteract the benefits, counteract the flaws of benefit and harm? So we have fewer more minutes. And I thought I would draw on something that I find very interesting. But we've covered the chapter, so now I can have 10 minutes. Having attended quite a number of meetings with His Holiness and meeting with very, very distinguished scientists, a theme has come up repeatedly. His Holiness has been very, very clear on this, that what the physicists, the biologists, and so forth, what they come to the table with, they're all really outstanding scientists, and they come with a very sophisticated knowledge, extensive knowledge, detailed knowledge of the laws of physics, for example. He's met with quite a number of physicists, Stephen Chu, a Nobel laureate, Anton Seilinger, David Finkelstein, the list goes on and on of just outstanding physicists he's met. And they know the laws of physics inside and out, classical physics, relativistic physics, quantum mechanics, the physics there, the laws of quantum mechanics, there's still laws there. And the question has come up, take a simple law, like inverse square law of gravity. Okay, it's exactly the inverse square law. It's down to hundreds of decimals. It's not more or less inverse square law, it's precisely, exactly inverse square law. And it could have been anything, but that's what it is. But mathematically, to any number of digits you want to calculate out to, it turns out to be extremely mathematical. And that's just the way it is. Okay, the force exerted by gravity falls away, inverse square. So the question comes up, well, why? Why is there such a law? Why is it the inverse square law, not inverse cube law? Or why is it not linear? It's not linear, it's not inverse cube, it's inverse square, right? Why? What caused that? And a very, very naive Buddhist might say, well, you know, karma. What can you say? Karma and klesha produces everything within samsara. So since karma produces everything, then it must be karma. But if you think it, so that would be a very naive, kind of uninformed and unreflective Buddhist would say, well, karma, you know, there's, you know, inverse square law karma. What the hell are you talking about? The inverse square law of gravity is not something pleasant. Yes, it is, actually. The tea flow right into my mouth following the laws of gravity. And it was quite pleasant. I like the inverse square law. Because otherwise I'd tip it and it would just stay in the cup. And it would be so annoying. On the other hand, if I drop this from a height on top of my head, then I'll find the inverse square law rather unpleasant. Right? So clearly the inverse square law is just ethically neutral. Which means then, what does it even conceivably mean to think a bunch of sentient beings got together and did something that gave rise to the inverse square law? It doesn't make any sense. And that's exactly what His Holiness said. It is not true that every aspect of a phenomenal world is generated by the karma of sentient beings. Because the karma is positive or negative, giving rise to pleasant and unpleasant experiences, felicity and adversity. But there's no karma that one individual or a bunch of individuals did that gave rise to, you know, the laws represented by Maxwell's four equations of electromagnetism. That's not the result of karma. The freezing point of water, it's not somebody's karma, you know. So there are many, many laws of nature, constants of nature. The freezing point of water, for example, very, very important. The the constitution, the atomic constitution of carbon, turns out to be enormously important for the emergence of life as we know it, organic life. It's extremely important. What sentient being did what to make sure that karma would turn out that way? And His Holiness's answer is, it's not a result of karma. The pleasant and unpleasant things that happen to you as reality rises up to meet you, these are the reflections of your karma, wholesome and unwholesome karma. But other things, he said, this is chunyi. That kowe chunyi ire. It's just, chunyi means, in this context, it just means, it's just the way things are. It's just the way things are. Why is the sky blue? The physicists will tell you. They will tell you. Why is it blue and not pink? Why is it not black? And the physicists will tell you why, you know. Whereas the Buddhists would say, well, it's the way things are. Sky during the daytime on a nice sunny day, blue. Sun is yellow, and so forth and so on. It's just the way things are. And that's it. There's really nothing more to be said. Nothing more of interest if your whole orientation is the Four Noble Truths. If you're really recognizing reality of suffering at source, you passionately want to get out of samsara and follow a path, do you really want to take time out to talk about why the sky is blue? I mean, you know, scientists are often driven by sheer curiosity, and that's considered to be a virtue. And well, I say, if that's what you want to do, I mean, it's cool. They come up with so many interesting things. We didn't really need to know about the Higgs boson. Whether that was worth $7 billion or no, I don't really know, but, you know, it's driven by curiosity. But Buddhism is not driven by curiosity. Our caring for about suffering and joy is not curiosity. It's something much deeper than that. Curiosity is a luxury. If you're impoverished, if you have a hard time even feeding your kids, you're not going to be that curious about that many things, except for how can we get some more food on the table. That's primal. Curiosity is a luxury for those who have things hedonic pretty well under control. But then, now we're having this interface between science and Buddhism, where in the best of times, and I've participated in meetings, it's a matter of coming together with mutual respect, both sides listening, learning from each other, recognizing the complementarity of the strengths and weaknesses or limitations of the Buddhist teachings and the discoveries and methodologies of modern science. And so it would be not inappropriate if we have a little bit of leisure time at the end of an afternoon to ask why. And if we take one step back into kind of foundational Buddhist cosmology that you find in the Abhidhamma, it's in China, Southeast Asia, India, Tibet, just basically how do the worlds come into formation? Abhidhamma. Then, I mean, there's an enormous amount that can be said, but to keep it a bit simple, this world that we experience, this physical and mental universe, where there's mind and all kinds of things happening, this is called the Kamadhatu, the desire realm. And it's in full swing right now. It's this Kamadhatu, this desire realm that we're inhabiting is clearly sufficient to support life, the next generation, and so forth. But at some point, it will be destroyed, and it wasn't always here. This physical, not just planet Earth, this physical universe from our perspective as human beings, this world, this desire realm, and that goes out to the furthest reaches of the galaxy and galaxies and the universe, that's all the desire realm, that this desire realm that we are experiencing wasn't always here. And it wasn't created by God or anything like that, so we just don't even need to look in that direction or build a whole infrastructure like modern science has based on the notion God created this some thousands of years ago. It's just not there. It doesn't come up. So where did this world emerge from? And it emerged from, in the classic Abhidhamma, which covers, you know, all of basically Buddhism all over Asia, this Kamadhatu emerged from the form realm in the cosmogony. The desire realm emerges from, it's an epiphenomenon, emerges from the form realm in the formation of a world system, a loka, it's called in Sanskrit, or jikden in Tibetan. And now the form realm, which is physical but not material as we understand material, is not made of atoms, material entities like we understand them in modern science, but it is physical. It is physical. There is space within the form realm, there are forms. There are, you can see, you can hear, you can touch, so forth, but it's on a much subtler level, physical but not material. And that's a differentiation that makes sense in modern physics. Electromagnetic fields are physical, but they're not material, they're not made of atoms. Simple. Many things are not made of atoms that are physical. But then where did the form realm emerge from? formless realm. And so things over time in these cosmic cycles, and it is cycles in the Buddhist understanding, a world system emerges in the sense of from the formless realm, the karmic energies of the sentient beings who will populate a certain world, they're activated, the symmetry is broken of just a formless realm, and out of that there emerges the form realm, very subtle, physical, but very subtle, and out of the form realm emerges this desire realm that we're so familiar with. And then eventually there will be the reversion, there's symmetry everywhere, and the desire realm will be destroyed, it will go back into the form realm, that will go back into formless. Now, the very notion that yogis, with no technology and really no sophisticated mathematics at all, Buddhism just doesn't have anything remotely like the sophistication of mathematics as we have in Western Eurocentric civilization. The very notion that a yogi could be sitting in a cave someplace in the Himalayas and have insights into evolutions of world systems, of planets, of galaxies, of the universe as a whole, is just not on the map. It's just not on the map at all. And so any physicist, I mean, almost with no exception, any physicist who even starts to hear a Buddhist talking about, well, our theory about the origin of the universe, that's just when the eyes go, like, whatever you're saying, it cannot possibly be of interest. I've already done it once with Genesis, and it just doesn't make any sense. What's your story? Go ahead, I'm listening, but please make it short. Because they can't literally, I'm not being sarcastic, they can't imagine that anything you'd come up by closing your eyes could tell you anything about what's happening outside, let alone a billion years ago. Even if it's pretty cool, they say, well, people have cool imaginations, people have stupid imaginations. You Buddhists have some pretty cool imaginations. That perspective really does make a lot of sense. I really understand it. There's nothing mysterious there. If you assume, as virtually all physicists accept, that consciousness emerges from matter. It's a derivative of matter. It emerges from sufficiently complex configurations of neurons. And the inanimate universe, the physical universe, was around billions of years before this planet formed, and billions of years before organic life occurred, billions of years before sentient life occurred, billions of years before human beings occurred. Therefore, consciousness has to play, at best, an infinitesimally small, insignificant role in the big picture of the universe at large. Because here we are, as Stephen Hawking said on one of his, I think, worst days, we're chemical scum. We human beings, we're chemical scum, wandering around on a nondescript little planet in a nondescript solar system on the outer suburbs of an ordinary galaxy among 100 billion galaxies. So, you know, you are almost inconceivably insignificant. And Stephen Hawking, again, I think he has made some amazing comments of brilliance and other ones that I would expect from a not very intelligent teenager. Consciousness is simply the software, the brain's the hardware. How does that grab you? Consciousness is the software, the brain's the hardware. When you die, your consciousness vanishes. That's what he said, 10 questions of Stephen Hawking in Time magazine. I thought, boy, Stephen, I thought you'd do better than that. But, you know, we all have our moments. But Stanford physicist, I've never met him. I know people, I know some Zen teachers who do, and they've corresponded with him. I never met him. I sent him a couple of emails, he didn't respond. But he's really very good. He's a Stanford physicist, very distinguished. He's Russian, but now Russian-American. He's been at Stanford for a long time. He's won awards, very, very mainstream, very, very bright. And just a few comments from him, and you'll see how this ties together. So Andre Lind writes, and I've copied this, you'll see exactly the source, you can read his whole paper. He writes, a healthy scientific conservatism usually forces us to disregard all metaphysical subjects that seem unrelated to our research. Very true. Exactly true. Yeah. However, in order to make sure that this conservatism is really healthy, and I would add, not just dogmatic, closed-minded and stupid, but really healthy, from time to time, one should take a risk to abandon some of the standard assumptions. This may allow us either to reaffirm our previous position or to find some possible limitations of our earlier point of view. Isn't that refreshing? I mean, really smart, that's what I would say. Really smart. Because he's not just going out on any, you know, any la-la kind of idea that comes up. He's not so stuffy that he said, what can you know? He's found, he said it so well, I won't say it again. He's just said it well. So he said, now let us turn to consciousness. The standard assumption is that consciousness, just like space-time, before the invention of general relativity, plays a secondary subservient role, being just a function of matter and a tool for the description of the truly existing material world. So interesting that he uses that term, right? That's not a translation. That's his term, a truly existing material world. But let us remember that our knowledge of the world begins not with matter, but with perceptions, with awareness. Getting better, yeah? This model of material world obeying laws of physics is so successful that soon we forget about our starting point and say that matter is the only reality and perceptions are nothing but a useful tool for the description of matter. Isn't that amazing? This assumption is almost as natural and maybe as false as our previous assumption that space is only a mathematical tool for the description of matter. We're substituting reality of our feelings by the successfully working theory of an independently existing material world. So we have our feelings, we're substituting reality of our feelings, we're substituting our whole subjective experience, our subjective world. We're just saying, bumping it out. Throw out your mind, your awareness, your perceptions, your experiences, throw those out. Chuck it out. Focus single-pointedly on the physical world. We're substituting the reality of our feelings by the successfully working theory of an independently existing material world. Just what I said earlier, that cognitive fusion with the objective. So you're not even aware of your feelings, your perceptions, your consciousness. So not even aware of it, then you say it doesn't even exist. What's the big deal? And the theory is so successful that we almost never think about its possible limitations. But he is now doing exactly that. And then he raises questions. Is it possible that consciousness, like space-time, has its own intrinsic degrees of freedom, and that neglecting these will lead to a description of the universe that is fundamentally incomplete? If you just write off consciousness, it's just an epiphenomenon of matter, just nothing, waste. Might our whole vision of reality be fundamentally incomplete if we have already forgotten our starting point, awareness? What if our perceptions are as real, or maybe in a certain sense are even more real than material objects? What if my red, my blue, my pain are really existing objects, not merely reflections of the really existing material world? Is it possible to introduce a space of elements of consciousness, and investigate a possibility that consciousness may exist by itself, even in the absence of matter, just like gravitational waves, excitations of space, may exist in the absence of protons and electrons? Just asking a question. That's how revolutions happen. You ask a question. Could it be, more questions, could it be that consciousness is an equally important part of the consistent picture of our world, despite the fact that so far one could safely ignore it in the description of the well-studied physical processes? So far means through the 19th century, until quantum mechanics came up and said, what's the role of the observer? What's the role of measurement? Then it's not so easy. Will it not turn out with the further development of science that the study of the universe and the study of consciousness are inseparably linked, and that ultimate progress in the one will be impossible without progress in the other? So he's just raising questions. What if he's right? which is to say, what if Buddhists, another contemplative tradition, but we're focusing on Buddhism. What if Buddhism is right? And the entire scientific vision of reality is fundamentally incomplete. Because they either ignore the mind or marginalize to the point of utter insignificance, which means what they're envisioning in the world is something that basically it's just their own concoction. It's a make-believe world in which mind doesn't exist and plays no role. What if he's right? What if his questions are actually spot on? What if? So hypothetical, why not? That's what scientists do. They think of thought experiments. What if that's the case? What if consciousness, not God's consciousness, not somebody else's consciousness, what if your consciousness, our consciousness, individual consciousness, what if this is absolutely as fundamental to the universe as anything else? Space, time, matter, energy, anything else you can conceive of. What if it's absolutely fundamental ingredient of reality? What if? That it was there at the beginning. Fundamental means it's not derivative at some later point in the evolution after the Big Bang. It was already there. Maybe it was there before. What if? What if the human mind is just the surface layer of a consciousness that goes all the way down to primordial, that's always been there, always been at the very foundation of physical reality, which is what he's saying. What if that? What if then you could penetrate through that thin chemical, not chemical, but that thin scum of your psyche, which is there and it's gone like a little flash of lightning. Whoop, whoop, your life just finished. What if you could penetrate through that? What if you could just penetrate to the substrate consciousness? And from that perspective, you could shine the bright light, the laser light of your awareness, back to your past life. But then what if, according to Buddhist accounts, Hindu swamis were doing this long before the Buddha came along. They were remembering 10,000 lifetimes. The Hindus were. Just power samadhi. That's all you need. You don't need vipassana. You don't need arahat. You don't need Buddhahood. Just samadhi. Get into that substrate consciousness and just get a really powerful generator for your laser attention and penetrate through 10,000 lifetimes. Why stop? If this substrate consciousness has no beginning and you can tap into that flow of memories, then you literally could be tapping into, like a time machine, you could be tapping into memories 1 million years old, 1 billion years old, 10 billion years old. It has no beginning. You could be tapping into memories before this whole cosmic cycle of the Big Bang began. You could tap into a memory 14 billion years ago and look at what was happening before this Big Bang. If it has no beginning, it has no beginning. In other words, you could get these snapshots from 1 billion years ago and 5 billion years ago and 10 billion years ago and so forth, and then come back and this is what I saw 5 billion years ago, 10 billion. You could write a whole cosmology without ever looking outside your window. You could be in Plato's cave and just go inside, and you could be retrieving memories from as far back in the history of the universe as you like. You'd just be looking out from all these windows wherever you happen to be embodied in any particular time. In the form realm, the formless realm, and then you could, from that perspective, you could say, well, there was whole periods when this world system wasn't even here, it wasn't formed yet, but there, I was, at that time, embodied in a form realm. Time before that, I was in the formless realm. There wasn't a form realm, it was dissolved. But then the time before that, I was in the desire realm, and that came, and that dissolved into, you could be telling about whole cosmic cycles with a whole bunch of snapshots, recalling just from the substrate consciousness. That's your substrate consciousness. That would be your own little train, your own little spaghetti of consciousness. Just getting snapshots from wherever you were, you know, in the universe at any given time. But you could tell a story. What's the history of the universe from your perspective, old timer? But imagine you to achieve something more than shamatha. Imagine you cut through. You cut through the substrate consciousness. And you tap into and are viewing reality from the perspective of pristine awareness, which saturates, permeates all of space and all of time. And it's non-local. Then, and this is Andre Linde, and this is kind of an extension of what he said, but he doesn't have the contemplative background, but this isn't exactly an extension of what he said. It's not somebody else's consciousness that is, you know, fundamental. It's the consciousness of every sentient being when you go down to the ground, that any sentient being of going down to the ground could write your own narrative of the history of the universe from the inside out. That's enough for today. But thank you, Andre Linda, for speaking with such clarity, such insight, such open-mindedness, and not pretending to have answers that he doesn't. I really, really respect that. Hola, so. Enjoy your afternoon.